A kind of a quick update on what happened yesterday on March 11th, Saturday, at the Food Not Bombs meal. I think I haven't mentioned it before in this particular show, but it looks like some private agency, perhaps on behalf of the feds, perhaps with city involvement, I'm not sure, has put up a fence, a 6 foot high or higher chain link fence all along the side of Water Street, facing the post office area where Food Now Bombs usually serves, and also fencing off most of the step area and everything but the main entrance of the post office, and plus, I guess, access for disabled up the ramp, although I didn't look at it that closely when I was down there today. In response, this seemed to be an attempt to drive away, if not, well, seriously impact people sleeping there, under the eaves of the post office at night when there's no legal shelter for more than 5% of the homeless population in Santa Cruz, and where Food Now Bombs feeds twice a week there, Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6, an attempt to drive away homeless people and make the area less hospitable and certainly more police state-y, more keep out, more barriers here, more gated community-like. In response, Food Not Bombs and other activists festooned the entire fence area with Food Not Bombs banners, posters, signs, and also some implements of kitchen implements and other clothes that were part of the weekend, and I guess it's once a month, really free market. I think it usually happens on one Sunday a month on the sidewalk near the Food Not Bombs meal, which is right outside the main post office on the corner there. And I received a call that mentioned that there were police officers there and that someone needed a camera down there, and I'd just gotten a video camera, so I hustled on down there. But by the time I got there, the police had left. And what I learned from activist Keith McHenry was that the police, some woman had begun tearing down the Food Not Bombs signs, and Keith had come back and patiently put them up again. And she was raging at Keith, this is by his account. And I'm calling the police, and he said, well, that's okay, they're welcome too. And the police came and asked him if he was going to remove the Food Not Bombs material when he left, and he said yes. And the police left. So there were no police officers. This is all McHenry's account. He's the co-founder of Food Not Bombs and a strong Santa Cruz activist around that issue. And he, I mentioned him earlier in the show. There were 100, 150 people there. I didn't count them, but that was somebody else's estimate throughout the afternoon. Things went on in a very peaceful, pleasant way. It was a very sunny day. It was beginning to get warmer. And I should remind you folks, if you haven't already, that today is when daylight savings time begins, March 12th. So make sure you kick your clock ahead an hour, or your, whatever device you use to keep time. I also did interviews around that area, but I'm not going to really be able to play them until the next show, because they haven't really been put up in the form that needs to be done technically. But I do have some earlier interviews. And a lot of the issues that people on the streets and the entire community faces are properly discussed and resonant again and again. I wouldn't say they're age-old, although they probably are, but they certainly can be illuminated by hearing interviews from earlier times. And I'm going to kind of catch up with some of the prior interviews I had with folks as we proceed now. So February 21st was the last city council meeting. It was also the famous council meeting that where police officers lined the walls. They locked the doors of the chamber. They wouldn't let people in for quite a period of time, in my mind, in violation of the Brown Act. And they did this on the pretext that the fire marshal had claimed that there was a 114 capacity or 118 capacity, some such thing, and that had been passed. And I've talked about this in past broadcasts, since we're talking about something that's almost 3 weeks old now. But while I was outside, while the it was a large crowd shivering outside because it was cold that night, and there were twice as many people locked out as were allowed in, and they did not choose to move this to the Civic Auditorium or any other place where that might have been a better venue, or the actual crowd may have been allowed, you know, the public may have been allowed into these public meetings, the so-called seat or center of government. And that, of course, is probably going to be the case on Tuesday, day after tomorrow, when the city council meets again. And there is a second reading of the so-called sanctuary law, which I may talk about a bit before the show is over, but you can certainly read about it on the Santa Cruz City website. If you go there, City of Santa Cruz agendas, and then just kind of follow the indicated links you need to reach it, and you'll get there. Some months back, I spent a lot of time talking about Proposition 64, opposing it. In fact, that's the marijuana legalization proposal, not because I oppose legalizing marijuana, but because the proposal, I was persuaded, significantly weakened protections for medical marijuana users, the doctors who issue recommendations for that use, as well as also heightened penalties for youth involved in marijuana, and didn't really address the issue of supporting marijuana growers who are currently supplying marijuana to people, admittedly, in a black market situation. One of the organizations that was involved in this whole process, the California Advocates Alliance, I think I have that right, Pat Malo is a guy who's been involved in this and also in the Board of Supervisors in-house C4 committee, which was supposed to propose some tame changes so that the Board of Supes could get past the people's veto that was exercised on their 2015 very severe marijuana cultivation restrictions. And what they did was they said, well, we're going to talk about this and let the community in and have all kinds of access. And they set up the C4 committee, whose recommendations were then mostly ignored, and instead proposed some rather stringent recommendations again. And this is Pat Malo's latest talk about this, plus you'll hear some of my critical comments. I wish I were better informed. I haven't yet really talked to an informed critic of, frankly, the position Malo and his organization have taken. But perhaps this discussion has some points on it that listeners here haven't heard, and I'm going to play it. All right, we're talking with a man about cannabis.
Pat Malo.
And Pat, I know that I've accused you of being a colluder with the noxious state ordinance in the last conversation we had. What's happening?
Well, so today, well, yesterday, let me back up. Right now, the cultivation ordinance is under environmental impact review. And yesterday, they had the first scoping session open to the public at Simpkins Swim Center. And basically, they're taking input to study, you know, the impact of the proposed draft, but then also different options. So, to cut to the chase, it's another opportunity to put some more of the more inclusive.
This ordinance, what kind of changes will we see from the current ordinance, good or bad?
Okay, so from the current ordinance of 7.126, what we have right now, this is a whole new paradigm of licensing, so you can go get your state license, which is
how much?
I mean, it is not known yet. Right now, the only costs that we have from the county are a $2,500 site inspection fee that doesn't promise anything but is just for your own benefit. So the license fee hasn't come out yet. But
what's your opinion of this fee?
Oh, it's going to be too much for any normal person, probably.
And I know that 2 years ago, or nearly now, there was an initiative, or I should say a referendum threatened, that effectively turned back
an anti, essentially an anti-cannabis ordinance by the Board of Supervisors. Can this happen again with respect to the county's most recent shenanigans?
Yeah, well, hopefully there will be some community momentum to get what normal people would need out of this. The EIR right now is an opportunity for small farmers, home cultivators to come out and demand that they study their options. Demand that in the EIR they study the impact of including more of the small cottage cultivators or smaller parcels or things like that. So the first step is getting those options covered in the EIR so that in down the line we wouldn't get sued if we had to get that. That makes kind of a scope of what we could do feasibly. Not totally, but that's
my thought. What about this concern we'd heard about the a mild coastal zone type ban on cultivation and a 1 acre, I have to be up at least 5 acres of cultivation, that sort of thing. Those were concerns that you and I think shared some months ago.
Yes, and so those are the exact things that we're submitting to the EIR right now to take a look at what the impact of an ordinance without that 5 acre minimum or without that 1 mile buffer or being able to expand things into different zoning like regular residential zoning, and that's what we're trying to convince
And what Pat Malo is talking about, as I recall, is it's a proposed ban by the Board of Supervisors on all cultivation a mile away from the coastal zone, which already extends significantly inward, covers at least half the city, I believe, if not more. And the other thing that we mentioned here was the fact that in order to cultivate marijuana at all and get a license, you have to be cultivating at least 5 acres. So it gives an advantage to and excludes the smaller growers. Also, of course, this whole thing is involving massive taxes is a way of funding more enforcement. And funding more enforcement means giving a motivation to agents to go out and find problems where there aren't any in order to exercise police powers that don't need to be exercised but that in fact become oppressive and abusive. This, of course, is well in line with the history of marijuana prohibition generally. But the notion of there being serious marijuana problems, with some exceptions in terms of, people growing in areas that create water problems or create fire dangers, there are specific problems that that are real and it should be addressed and are a matter of concern. But the notion of treating marijuana dispensaries, for example, as toxic sites in some way that can't be located near child care centers or schools, with the notion that it's somehow a danger when you, in fact, you have places selling liquor and toxic cigarettes in the same areas, or even more dangerous pharmaceutical products, is just an example of the bigotry which marijuana is treated with and which is now being incorporated and in essentially enshrined and embedded in the laws. A clearer sense of exactly what the proposed law is on the table, if there is one on the table now. I've heard from Pat Malo in the past that we don't have to worry too much about this right now because this environmental review will take a long time. It'll be an opportunity for public comment. I don't know about that. I mean, I think the time to begin fighting this issue is as soon as you can to educating people about, sanity rather than the insanity of essentially the drug war under a different flavor, under a different label, under a different color. Pat was big on getting people to sign up for licenses last fall when I had the feeling or just had the idea that if enough people refused to do the sign up, the law would indicate to the legislators this attempt to get everybody in line was not going to work and that they have to go back to the drawing table. Now, they were using the state law as their pretext because there is a state marijuana law which was essentially transferred to and enshrined in Proposition 64, another reason that some of us didn't like Proposition 64. I don't feel entirely secure in a lot of these criticisms, though, because I don't really have the... it was an extremely lengthy and elaborate text, and I never had the advocates and the opponents really clearly available for a dialogue. This is often the case. I've often, for example, to have fluoridation and anti-fluoridation people talking with each other about the very specific allegations, so people can get some understanding of the merit or lack of merit of any particular argument. Anyway, let's hear some more from Pat and the conversation I had with him outside a city council meeting that was supposedly protecting, providing sanctuary for immigrants, although not really, because there's no enforcement proposed, no enforcement mechanism against the officers who spill the beans to the Immigration Service or continue to have an ICE agent working at the police station, as Chief Vogel admitted he did when it was finally brought to his attention, or I should say, when he was confronted with that allegation. I just wonder if there's going to be the same kind of outrage 2 days from now, because you can muster the outrage once, but people then seem to their attention strays to something else, at least in terms of local militant action against anything, whether it's the Bearcat armed vehicle that was apparently it's been around, but it didn't save Sean Arlt's life, or this latest hogwash around the abusive raids in the Beach Flats, supposedly to catch these high-level criminals, but which also seem to pick up people who did not have their papers in order, all with the collusion of the Santa Cruz Police Department. Unless massive numbers of people show up at City Council and make demands, the City Council goes on its usual way of rubber stamping police department policies or covering them over or apologizing for them and then just allowing the police department to continue doing what it did before.
EIR to include in their more permissive option, as they're calling it. And that would be laying the foundation to say, here's one option that works better, you know, and then if the board...
If you can't get this, or you think you are prepared, or is there enough interest and financial backing to actually independently establish either as initiative or as a referendum these more liberal provisions?
I hope that once we get a clear picture of who's being excluded and who this ordinance won't work for, there's enough resources in that group to be able to get something going. But we're looking at a timeline where that probably isn't happening in time for the 2018 state licensing program. So everybody's kind of in a pinch, and so we're taking steps, or at least I'm taking steps towards, you know, working with the county to get that more permissive option in the hopes that it will get adopted one way or another. But if I had more resources myself, or any resources myself, I would have definitely a while ago gone straight to the initiative option, because just to keep the fire going.
Because I know I was proposed, months and months ago. In fact, the only reason I think we got any kind of a resolution out of the group you were in was, you know, I butted into the room and raised my hand and said, oppose, what was it, Proposition 64?
Yep.
So what with the passage of 64, some of the concerns by the opponents were that this would seriously impact medical marijuana providers, particularly doctors. What's been your sense of that?
So that piece of things, the effect it's going to have on the patients and the ability for doctors to write referrals the way that they've been doing now hasn't rolled out, and that is also associated with the state regulations that were passed last year, the MRSA, or now they've changed it to MRCA, to be more politically correct.
And what we're hearing here from Pat, and I'm probably was somewhat distracted by other things happening at the time. But, you know, we're not getting a direct answer. I mean, my concern is that doctors are going to be now more discouraged from writing recommendations. Also, when I mentioned that his organization, the California Advocates, Cannabis Advocates Alliance, or some such, until very late in the election year last year, took no position against the Proposition 64 or a series of critical comments about what was missing in it and what needed to be addressed. And they wouldn't take a position against it until someone completely outside the organization, that was me, I walked into the room where they were having their meeting and I said, I asked, are you opposing this? And they said, well, no one's actually raised that issue. And I said, okay, I'd like to suggest that you do that. And then they all unanimously opposed it. But, you know, it didn't mean too much when it was done 2 or 3 weeks before the election, when they had no... They did sponsor one... I'm not sure if they sponsored him, but we did have one critical speaker who came in and gave a very elaborate analysis of why he felt Proposition 64 was a loser for marijuana advocates. And I still got a bag of his anti-64 buttons. But the CAA didn't have much to do with it, and neither did Pat Malo. And I think I denounced this at the time, and though Pat's a nice guy, and he's a patient fellow to want to be interviewed by someone who's critical on these issues, but that's good. That's all to the good. Let's hear some more.
State regulations would yield the Proposition 215 until Proposition 64 passed. What impact do you think 64 has had on 215?
Well, so my answer is basically the same as the last one, is that this new system that's coming in January 1st, 2018 has the possibility of basically devastating the more cottage, smaller producers in the regulated cannabis
market. Forgetting about the producers, what about the consumers?
So the consumers are in a situation where there's going to be more and more tax burdens applied to their medicine if they're shopping at dispensaries.
To get a doctor to give you a recommendation for medical marijuana.
So we haven't seen how that's going to all roll out at this point yet.
Doctors pulled in their heels, you know of, and or pulled in their horns.
No, not yet. And people are still there's online Skype consultations. Still happening right now, so it's still fairly loose, and that aspect of it I don't think we've seen at the state level what exactly that's going to look like with the rules, but we know that it is going to be there are going to be rules coming, and the what is really affected is the idea of a medical collective, and that's going to be limited, where you have to, it more closely defines the primary, what it means to be a caregiver. You have to be a primary caregiver, and some people may even say live with those people, and you're limited at 5 medical patients.
Now, is that inside the actual Proposition 64, or is that the state's latest horseshit?
That's the state's latest horseshit, and that has been the crux of what has cut out, what I would say is the core, or at least some of the origins of 215, the idea that people should be able to come together and cultivate their own medicine.
Now, has 215 actually been cut out that way? And if so, what provision of 64 did that?
Well, so I don't think that 215 has been cut out yet, except for that it got limited. So people would argue that this 215, you still have your 215 rights. They're just limited at 5 people for your collectives if it's non-commercial. And so this, the ability to be part of a bigger collective and maybe donate some of your excess that you cultivated and have, get some money back for your time and materials, that model that basically sustained all the local collectives for years has kind of been...
Been removed specifically by the 64 language.
No, it has been, that whole system is phased to transfer into this local
permission in the form of permits or licenses and a state license. And that doesn't go into effect until hypothetically January 1st, 2018.
But is that required by Proposition 64?
No, 64 locks in certain aspects of...
In other words, what changes would prohibit someone from saying, bullshit, I'm going to keep doing what I've done because Proposition 215 enables me to do that?
Well, so that would be something that someone, I've heard from lawyers and different people that there still might be some hypothetical coverage in criminal, you know, in a criminal situation and get criminal protection if you were cultivating more than these for these five patients.
What about a doctor? Does a doctor have protection? Or is he more limited now than, or she, wherever, you know, when they want to recommend cannabis?
You know, I believe that it's going to be more limited. I don't know about...
Is that specifically authorized? Because that was one of the concerns of those opposed to 64.
Well, yeah, and that, again, that is, from my understanding, is because 64 was written to line up with the recent state...
But you don't recall a particular provision.
No, no. And then what that would be in is in the state regs, the one bill that was...
state regs, again, would succumb to or be superseded by 215 unless 64 is...
Yes, until 64 passed. And that
comma
was
is another word for 64.
Yeah, and that is that was the concern on a lot of the, you know, cannabis activist side of things, is that there was a lot of problems with the state MRSA bills, and 64 would kind of cement those in and make it so that you couldn't challenge them in court.
So you're with the Cannabis Advocates Alliance.
Yes.
And your next meeting is?
We are now talking about doing co-meetings with Santa Cruz, the new Santa Cruz Normal chapter, and they have meetings, and we will probably now having meetings the first Thursday of every month at Bocce Cellar at 7 o'clock.
And tell folks where Bocce Cellar is.
It is down by Harvey West, across from the county gas station, I think. But
you know the name of the road?
No, I don't.
I think I've actually passed by it. It's one of those roads that's parallel.